I can see. I'll be fine. Well, howdy. I've got handouts. I didn't print. There's more here than I anticipated. There's 7 sets. Whoever wants one to follow along, or you can pick one up afterwards if you say that mattered to me or it didn't. That's okay. Or I can email you a PDF of it. Before we get there, though, it's so good to be here with you guys, and it's been nice to be with you guys, a week and a half now? I just want to thank you. I've been pondering. It's been 5 years. Well, in September, it'll be 5 years since the first time I came. Yeah, and so I wanted to recap a little bit of my journey, and then what I'm going to be doing in Jerusalem, and then we'll get into this other thing, which is part 3. The Lord gave me like 3 teachings, and I did them here kind of over these 5 years, and in other places, I've done them in a course of, actually one place I did it in one day, and another place I did it over the course of several weeks. So this is part 3. The first one was why Israel, when we went through Romans 9, 10, and 11. The second part that I did last time I was here, which was 16 months ago, remembering Ishmael. And now this is going to be part 3, Israel and the nations. And just kind of an explanation of some of the political things that happened. Actually, the month after I left here, there were some things that happened. And that's just about to come into fruition, I think. And we'll talk a little bit about that. But in 2008, I was living in Minnesota. I'm from Texas, as you guys know. But I've been all over the U.S., the western side of the U.S. And I was in Minnesota. I had been freelancing as a wedding photographer, and I had worked for a studio for a little bit, and I quit that to just do the weddings, and then wedding season was coming to the end. I'm a terrible freelancer. I like people to give me work instead of me going to find it. I was working as a contractor for a wedding company at the time, and that was easy work. They would just say, go to cover this wedding. I'd cover it. I'd email them I'd send them a DVD of the photos, and I was done. And then they'd pay me. Anyway, so it was the end of the wedding season. And if you remember, the fall of 2008 is when the stock market crashed in the U.S. And I know it affected everybody. There was economic turmoil all over the world. And I was at church on a Sunday night. And the pastor said, I want to pray for those who are in economic trouble. If you're looking for work or you have problems with money, come up for prayer. And so I went. I said, you know, Lord, I need a job. So I go up to the line, and pastor's way over there, and he hasn't even gotten anywhere near me. But the instant I stepped up to the front, in front of the stage, I heard the Lord very clearly within my spirit. It was not audible. Your job is not here. It is in Israel. And this took me aback. It wasn't a total shock. I went back through my journals when I was home this last year, and I saw that the Lord had been talking to me about Israel consistently, and I'd been studying. And so here was this word, and I took it very seriously. It was that heavy that it dropped into my spirit. I believed it with all my heart, and I started packing up my life in Minnesota. The following February, I drove down to Texas to spend some time with my family, continue selling off some of my things, actually almost everything. I sold just about everything except my cameras, my computer, and, you know, the clothes that I needed to wear, and that's it. And something else happened that February. As you guys know, I had been blogging, and that's where I met Nisia. And that February, she did that drive with me over texting and messaging. And so she kept me company on my drive home. That was the first time we really engaged. And then I finally got the money. I felt clearance from the Lord. I bought an airplane ticket. And in May of 2009, I flew to Israel. I knew one person there. She was nowhere near Jerusalem. I actually didn't see her till right before I left. And then you guys know the rest of the story. I didn't feel like I could go home. So I came here, And the Lord gave me a six-month sabbatical here to hear him and to meet you guys and to learn some things and to continue pressing on for this job in Israel that I still couldn't figure. I went looking for a newspaper job. I sent resumes, and I even interviewed at a newspaper in Tel Aviv that summer, but nothing came of it. I learned about the house of prayer, and then the Lord pushed me in that direction. So here we are. It's 4.5 years later, and I'm headed to this job. So, yes, hallelujah. So, let's see, you're going to work. There it is. That'll be my office. No, that's actually on the compound of Christ Church in the Old City. That's the church building, but there's a whole compound around it with a bookstore, a kind of cafeteria restaurant that people can come in for meals, but they also feed the staff. And then there's a guest house to the back over there. You can rent a room there. They rent out. Once I find out more information, you guys can contact me about how much their guest room stuff cost. It's right in the Old City, right when you walk in the Jaffa Gate. It's just a great compound. I would have never walked into it because it's an Anglican church. And I grew up non-denominational, independent, charismatic church, big church in my city, and wary of the older denominational churches, big Catholic area where I'm from. So I hadn't even gone in there the first two times I went. And then through a series of things, I went in there, I ended up shooting a conference there, I got to meet some people, and that opened the door for me to go and work for them. What I'm going to be doing is, well, what I think I'm going to be doing, everything's flexible in Israel, is multimedia volunteer, focusing right now mostly on social media. They have no social media presence, so I get to play on Facebook and Twitter all day. So I'm going to set up a page for them and try to keep it active. I want to start a blog for them. And the other thing I'm going to help, well, there's a lot of things, but the main things that are on my mind is to help digitize their more than 150 years worth of archives. They've got photographs and journals from the founding of the church and everything. The history of Israel is through the eyes of the rectors there and everybody else there. And I'm just salivating at the chance to look at these photographs, these old photographs, and to scan them in. And I would hope that would be the content that drives the social media and the blog, is to share these photos. Because at first I was thinking, you know, Lord, this is history. I've always loved history, but that's why I got into journalism. And I thought, this is looking back. Why are we looking back? I don't want to look back, Lord. I keep looking forward. But I finally realized that a lot of people don't realize how faithful the Lord has been about Israel. And the one thing that clicked with me, and I'm going to show you a little video about Christ Church, and they'll tell you a little more, but what really clicked with me is I think it was 1849, the church was established. It wasn't finished till a little further on. And that's 100 years before the rebirth of the nation, and it's 30 years before Zionism really takes hold among the European Jews, this idea of we got to go home. And so before even that is birthed in the Jewish mind, the Lord drops a bunch of Christians there, Protestants. This is the first Protestant church in the whole Middle East. And what do? They start breaking the ground. Is what they start doing. And the first bishop, Anglican bishop, was a Messianic Jew named Alexander Solomon, or Solomon his last name. I'll have to look him up. But anyway, he was a Messianic Jew. And so from the very start, it was meant to be a mission to the Jews to say, hey, your Messiah has come. So I'm very excited. And so is the sound ready, Nisio?
Thank you. Christ Church Spitalfields in the UK's capital. It is out of this church, here in London's East End, that Christ Church in Jerusalem is named. And in the area surrounding this church, 200 years ago, CMJ's story began.
At the end of the 18th century, the world was experiencing great change. Revolution in France had raised expectations that the last days were approaching. Christians began to be more aware of the probability of the imminent return of Jesus.
They saw in Scripture that in order for this momentous promise to be fulfilled according to prophecy, the land of Israel must be reborn into the hands of the people to whom God had given it. They realized that the gospel had to be preached as God intended, to the Jew first.
In 1809, that a group of Christian people, some clergy, some laity, met together to form a society. They called it the Society for the Promotion of Christianity Among the Jews. Later it became known as the London Jews Society, or LJS, and today it's known as the Church's Ministry Among Jewish People, or CMJ. And in the record book of that first meeting, it said like this: "We therefore have thought it proper and suitable to the glory of God to establish a society for the sole purpose of exciting the attention of the Jews to the words of eternal salvation."
Missionaries went out from Great Britain, across Europe and beyond, to many major cities with significant Jewish populations, including Vienna, Warsaw, and Tehran. They were joined by people of various nationalities sharing the vision of CMJ. A bishopric was established in Jerusalem, and a Messianic Jew, the Reverend Michael Solomon Alexander, was consecrated in 1841 as the first bishop. This led, after much turmoil, to the building of the first Protestant church in the Middle East, and the only Christian church to be built in the Ottoman Empire. The foundation stone of the church was laid 35 feet below the surface on Jerusalem's bedrock. That church is Christ Church, Jerusalem. In 1948, the State of Israel was born and the prophetic clock moved on.
The work, which began here in the East End of London, had now spread across the world, and Jewish people were hearing the gospel, most significantly in the Holy Land itself. This is the story of CMJ. This is the history we celebrate.
Well, the work has taken off, because since 1948, and Israel has been populated by more and more Jews from all around the earth, then the task of the Christian church in Jerusalem and in Israel is still the same, which is simply to explain the gospel to Jewish people and to let them know what it is that their own heritage has brought to us of the prophets, of Jesus, of the way of salvation, and the fact that he is their Messiah. And we cannot but go and let them know this. And so this is what CMJ is still doing today.
So that's a little bit about the history of CMJ. So I was very excited. At first I was like, I didn't know if I wanted this position. Once I found this video, I wish I'd found it a year ago. I just found it a few months ago. And it really excited me that that I'm going to be serving there and that this is their mission. And then one more thing about this morning. I really appreciated the word given this morning, and I wanted to just reinforce it. A lot of what she said, Rick Ridings has been saying over the last couple of months. The verse in Job about a tree that's been cut down, but its roots look for water, and it re-buds. That's been a word that got spoken over Syria, because, of course, Syria is a mess right now. And we have to remember, we forget, Syria, after Israel, Syria became the cradle of the church. That's where Paul was based. And so praying that over that, and I was also prayed over the states, particularly in the 13 colonies area, the New England area, because there's a real spirit of humanism and that oppressing the universities over there. So a prayer that the roots, the first university, Harvard University, was a seminary. That's what it started as. And they've gone so far from that. So it was so good to hear that word spoken here for Wales and for Britain to say, you know, go back, that those roots are still there and all they need is a little water. So pray into that. And then she talked about the running river that she heard when she went to that conference. And 4 years ago, I think it was 4 years ago, and I was here. It was a prayer time, or maybe I was praying on my own. I don't remember. I saw a vision of a river running out of here into the street. I saw it very clearly within myself, that it would just refresh the whole community. And so I just wanted to encourage you guys to continue the work. And I know there's been many words spoken, so I just wanted to encourage you. I had Purim wrong. It's Purim's today. It's today. For such a time as this. And this word is about that. For such a time as this. Okay. No? Keep going the wrong way. There we go. So we're going to look at a little bit of history. Lots of maps. And so if you want to remember the maps, they're in the printouts there. How international votes now affect Jesus' judgment of the nations. And this is a word for intercessors. This is a word for you to pray for your nation and for the other nations, all the nations that you're related to or have a heart for. As always, my usual disclaimer, don't take my word for it. Always study this out. It's so easy now with the internet to study out history. There's so many sources that are at our fingertips, literally at our fingertips. Like these maps that you're going to see, they were produced by a university in the States, and they put them up for free for anybody to use. And so there's just so much information out there. So don't take my word for it. We realize that history has two point of view, so some people might not like this version of history, but it is our responsibility to see the world through the prism of the Bible. And that's what's very important. Not to get caught up in politics and all of that, but to just see what does God say and whether or not we believe him. So, okay. And the watchword for me, this has been the watchword for me for about a year, maybe two now. No, a good year. Be sober and be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, as a roaring lion, walks about seeking whom he may devour. And if you read 1 Peter, it's about the last days. And this word really jumped out at me. For those of you who hang out on Facebook with me, you see all the things that are flying, the conspiracy theories, the accusations in the States. It's really bad. Bickering that happens, the political bickering, the Obama bashing, whatever it is, the Muslim bashing, all of that. And I really, this word is for that. Let us be sober and be vigilant. And let's be careful about what information we disseminate. Do you know where it's coming from? Have you verified it? Are you being malicious? Because I see a lot of malice sometimes on the internet. Because people, it's so easy, because we feel separated, I guess. We don't have to do it face to face. So let's be careful about what information we pass forward, but also let's be vigilant. I believe we are entering, as Chuck Missler says, a time that the Bible says more about than anything else. And it's one of his challenges for you to question and to challenge that. But just in a cursory reading of the prophets and even the New Testament, there's always this forward-looking to the last days. And there's a lot of things to me that says we're very close to that. It's nearly upon us. So let us be sober and vigilant. All right. So we know about the Genesis 12 that God told Abraham that he would bless those who blessed him and curse those who cursed him. There's versions of this t-shirt. This is a t-shirt. First time I saw it, I laughed, but I thought it was too arrogant to wear. But I did snag a picture of one somewhere. And it says, civilizations, nations, and empires that have tried to destroy the Jewish people. And it's got ancient Egypt, the Philistines, the Syrians, the Babylonians. It goes down all the way to Iran. It says, gone, 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 gone. The Nazis, gone. The Soviet Union, gone. Iran, question mark, question mark. Question mark. It is rather arrogant, but isn't that what Genesis 12 says? And here is a list that sells like hotcakes, I think, in Jerusalem. But here is a list of proof of God's faithfulness, that when a nation doesn't deal rightly with Israel, they are wiped from the map. They really are. And so this should prompt us to intercede for our nations, because we're in a very precarious time. And I'm going to show you what is happening and why I got alarmed and have been alarmed, and I think you should be alarmed. I keep pressing the wrong button. Okay. The UN says Palestine is a state. What's the big deal? So in November of 2012, well, let's go back a little bit. In November of 2011, the Palestinians made a resolution to the Security Council. The Security Council in the UN is the only one that can make nations, if you will. We're seeing a lot of Security Council stuff right now with Crimea and what's happening there. And so the Palestinians said, please make us a state. You do it, because we can't talk to Israel anymore. This is ridiculous. Thankfully, everything stalled out. There have been a lot of words about 11-11. That was November 2011. And in the end, the U.S. promised to veto and also managed to talk out other members to not vote. And in the end, it was tabled. It never even got to a vote. So everything got stalled out for a year. But how did this all start? This all started in May of that same year, 2011. So I'm reading the news, and this headline just jumps out at me. It whacked me intellectually. It whacked me spiritually. Obama told Israel to go back to the pre-1967 lines. And in the end, it turned out, if you see, you read a lot of things, it says, oh, every president has always said this. This has always been part of the peace deal negotiations, and we're going to talk about what these lines are and what they mean. But Obama was the first one to actually speak it out publicly to the press corps so that it got publicized in all of the international media. And so it really resonated with me, and I was like, okay, what is he saying here? So at this point, Abbas, Mahmoud Abbas, is the president of the Palestinian Authority. And he had been kind of trying to negotiate with Israel. Some people felt he wasn't being aggressive enough. And when Obama said this, Obama was being more aggressive than Mahmoud Abbas. So he had to do something to save face. So what did he say? Well, we're going to the UN, and we're going to demand nation status. And so that first vote fails. And then the next year, they're like, they're trying to talk, but things aren't quite going. They're upset because Israel keeps okaying what are considered settlements by the international community, some of which are out in the West Bank, some of which are Jerusalem. But because of Jerusalem having been reunited in 1967, as we'll see, people think anything outside of those old lines are settlements. Okay, so that's one of the big stumbling blocks. So Abbas, again, in November 2012, took the vote for the UN, but this time he went for a more ceremonial vote. He went to the whole General Assembly, I think it's 192 nations in the UN. And this time the resolution did go to a vote and it passed. And it didn't establish anything legally, but I think in the spirit realm, it really started putting nations in that goat nation category, as we'll see, and it was very, very dangerous. So let's see, what does this mean historically, and what does this mean biblically and prophetically? Okay. So we're going to go back to about 1915. World War I is raging. The Germans have, and the Axis powers have united with the Ottoman Empire out of Turkey, a Muslim empire. And so Britain, two things happen. The Jews are really pushing for Zionism. We want to go home, we want to go home. Let us go back to Israel. And they get the what is very famous Balfour Declaration in 1917. And that was Britain saying, yes, we believe that Israel should have a homeland back in the Middle East, back in its biblical geographical area, and we're going to give them that. This is what it looked like, okay? Well, something else happened that I didn't know until I started researching that. This. In 1915, we have the McMahon-Hussein correspondence. So desperate to get the Arabs to help fight the Ottomans, this guy, he's a UK diplomat. I don't know his level. I wish I had that written down. Anyway, he was a UK diplomat to the Prince of Mecca, and he told them, we'll give you this land if you help us fight the Ottomans. So now we have the same entity promising the same piece of land to two peoples who hate each other. And thus it begins, or continues, right? Because as we saw before, this goes all the way back to Ishmael and Isaac. But here we have it re-stirred up again. So when the war ends, Britain and France divide the Middle East up for themselves. And the Brits get this. You guys get this. So, now, what do we do? Fighting starts. Highly suggest the recommended book is Appointment in Jerusalem by, do I have it written here? Lydia Prince, Derek and Lydia Prince. It is an awesome book. And it really gives you a first-person account of what was happening there in the 1920s. When the Arabs started bucking because all of a sudden these Jews are coming out of Europe and coming here to resettle Israel. And there's fighting and fighting that's going to escalate 20 years down the road after World War II. That's Appointment in Jerusalem. I see you pulling out your pen. By Derek and Lydia Prince. It's a really cool story. So, when the war ends, so many things happen during World War II, but we were not going to cover that. When the war ends, Britain says, we've had it. We can't referee these two groups anymore. We're getting out. We will get out in 1948. So the UN decides to try to fix this. Keep pressing the wrong button. Okay. So in 1947, the UN comes up with this map. And said, let's divide the land. Oh, let me backtrack a little bit. If you notice, we've lost a big chunk of land. So right where the Jordan River runs, everything to the east became Jordan. It's called the Transjordan area. It became the nation of Jordan, the kingdom of Jordan. And it was given to the family, the Hashemite family, that had really helped out during the war. And they control it to this day. They're a minority government, much like in the Middle East. They're all minority governments. Not all, but many of them. So now we're left with this. And all of a sudden we have the Palestinians, the so-called Palestinians, and the new Jews who want a new Israel, and they're fighting. So the UN comes up with this map. And if you notice, everything in yellow was going to go to the Jews. No. Yes, everything in yellow was going to go to the Jews. Everything that's a little darker was going to be an Arab zone. And Jerusalem was going to be an international zone. And I think that's very important because I suspect We're going to see a version of this in the next few years with Jerusalem as an international zone, and we'll talk about why. Jerusalem is what's holding everything up, the division of Jerusalem. So this goes to vote in the UN. It passes. The Jews say, yay, we get some land. And the Arabs say no. And they don't even say thank you. They just say no, we don't want this. They reject it. More fighting happens. Britain says, we're out of here. And they pull out on, what was it, May 15, 1948. So on May 14, because May 15th was a Shabbat, on May 14, David Ben-Gurion declares Israel a nation, independent, and of course they get attacked the very next day. And so begins the War of Independence. So they fight it out for about a year and a half. And we end up with this. And this is the map that's important to us. This is the armistice lines, the ceasefire lines of 1949. So we see what becomes known as the West Bank. Jerusalem's right here in this little crevice. And then everything else is Israel. We have the Gaza Strip, which had been controlled by Egypt, I believe, till the 1967 war. The Golan Heights here are cut off and are part of Syria. And we have this comes out of Lebanon, I think more recently here in the early 2000s. But this is what the map looks like from 1949 to 1967. And when Obama said in 2011, Israel needs to go back to the 1967 lines, what he really meant is the 1949 lines, because they ceased to be the lines in 1967. So he wants the map to look basically like this. And then we'll come back to this. So then in 1967, tensions start building again. They're fighting over some passage rights, water rights. Israel gets wind of the fact that they're about to get attacked again, and they do a preemptive strike. And in 6 days, they have conquered all their Middle East neighbors. And the map changes dramatically again. So Israel manages to knock out Egypt's air force while it's on the ground. They don't even get on the ground. They just bomb it. Done. And they manage to fight off the Jordanians and the Syrians, and they take everything. They take the Golan Heights, which they still have to this day, even though the international community says that it's illegal. Here we have the West Bank that the Palestinians want for their country. Here we have the Gaza Strip attached to the Sinai Peninsula. In the 70s, Israel famously made peace with Egypt and gave them back the Sinai Peninsula. And right now it's a big sore spot again because Egypt's having trouble patrolling it and it's become a hotbed of Islamic militants. And we saw that terrible bus bombing of a tourist bus. I don't know if you saw the details. It was a South Korean church group that had saved all their lives to travel to Israel. And they were in the wrong place at the wrong time, unfortunately. I'm going to say something really strange. I've noticed that when these things happen, there was a bus bombing a few years back when I wasn't there. And the only person who died was a Christian. And I felt, this is a strange thing to say, but it's the Lord's mercy. He takes those that already know him because they get to go home. Everybody else survives because they've got to know him before they leave this place. I know that's a hard word. But, so, all right, so let's fast forward a little bit. So this is roughly Israel today. In 2005, Israel disengaged from the Gaza Strip. Ariel Sharon gave it back to the Palestinians. And as you saw, there was big news. Mr. Sharon, shortly thereafter, had a stroke and was in a coma until just a few months ago. And he's just now passed away. And there had been a prophetic word among the rabbis that when Ariel Sharon died, Messiah would come. And he has passed, so they are watching. And a lot of things are accelerating right now. So here we have the Golan Heights. Okay, Ramallah is the de facto capital of the Palestinian Authority, but they want Jerusalem as their capital. Okay. So let's go back to this map. What is significant about this map, to me, is let's zoom in on Jerusalem. This is where my heart really was heavy when I saw Obama say, go back to the 1967 lines. Because why? Because in 1949, when they had the ceasefire, the city of Jerusalem was divided. Okay? So here we have this little brown line here was Jerusalem from 1923 to 1947. When they call ceasefire, the city, the green line, the armistice line, comes here, and it divides the city in about a third and two-thirds or a quarter. But all of this becomes Jordan, and the old city was Jordanian. So for 19 years, the Jews could not go to the Western Wall to pray. They destroyed all the synagogues in the old city. They burnt all the Torah rolls, scrolls. And there was barbed wire. It's very interesting to me because Sukkot Hillel, they just moved. But they used to be right about here. And then it drops down into what is the Gehinnom Valley. And then you go up into the old city. And right before it dropped into the valley, there was nothing but barbed wire. Nothing but barbed wire. I can only imagine how sad it would have been to live in Jerusalem at that time and to be able to see the old city but not go to it. Because that's the heart of it. And down here, right off what we know as the old city, is the ancient city of David. There's an archaeological dig there. So all of that was in Jordan. So when the world says, go back to the 1967 lines, this is what they mean. Divide the city. Divide the city. Once Israel took Jerusalem back, it grew out to here, and then it grew out to here, and this is roughly the borders today. So today, you would cut all of this off. There's an airport up there. You would cut all of this off. Bethlehem's down here. Bethlehem is already Palestinian controlled. Trying to remember when. I should know my dates. But it was under Bill Clinton. They gave the Palestinians 10 cities, 10 big cities, including Bethlehem, Jericho, Ramallah. In the Bible, Shechem, in the modern day, it's called Nablus. And what's interesting, Hebron, what's interesting is all those cities are the biblical cities that Abraham traveled through. And they were taken away from Israel in for peace. The whole Abraham trail is in Palestine, which is why they try to claim now that Jesus is a Palestinian. But that's a whole another joke that makes me laugh every time I hear it. Okay. So here's the map again. So this demand to divide Jerusalem is spiritually explosive because they're endorsing the dividing of Jerusalem. And what does the Lord have to say about that? He has some very harsh things to say. Joel 3. For then at that time, when I restore the fortunes of Judah and Jerusalem, I will gather all the nations and bring them down to the valley of Jehoshaphat, which means Adonai judges. I will enter into judgment there for my people, my heritage Israel, whom they scattered among the nations. Then they divided my land. And it goes on. So God is very clear that he will judge the nations on how they treat Israel for scattering Israel and for dividing the land. And I believe that Jesus expounds on this in Matthew 25. When the Son of Man comes in his glory, accompanied by all the angels, he will sit on his glorious throne. All the nations will be assembled before him, and he will separate people one from another as a shepherd separates sheep from goats. The sheep he will place at his right hand and the goats at his left. So I looked up all the nations there. And we get, this is what it looks like. Because it's like, okay, who are all the nations? The Greek word pos there is individually, each, every, any, all, the whole. So that's all things, everything, everyone. And then the other word is ethnos, a multitude, associated, living together, a tribe, a nation, a people group. And in the Old Testament, the foreign nations not worshiping the true God, the Gentiles, the goyim in Hebrew. And so here he's saying all the goyim will be judged on how we treat Israel. Now, I believe that this is talking about nations, okay? This is not about individual salvation. This is about judgment of nations, how they exist, if they exist, and how they get restructured. Because if you read, let me see, in Joel, when you see nations, it's goyim. So this is the Greek equivalent. So what does Jesus say? Because you remember, this is still a continuation of Matthew 25. Then the king will say to those on his right, come you whom my Father has blessed, take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you from the founding of the world. For I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you made me your guest. I needed clothes and you provided them. I was sick and you took care of me. I was in prison and you visited me. Then the people will say, Lord, when did we do these things? And the king will say to them, yes, I tell you that whenever you did these things for one of these least important brothers of mine, you did them for me. Now, this verse is always passed on as this is how we need to treat people. And I think that's true, how we treat ourselves in the community. But we need to look at the context and the first reading of this. What has Jesus just been talking about? The judgment of the nations. And he says, I'm going to separate them to the left and to the right. And this is what I'm going to tell the ones on the right, and this is what I'm telling the left. So he's talking about the nations here. And what does he say? These brothers of mine, how did you treat these brothers of mine? And I do believe that the first definition here is his natural brothers. The word is adelphos. A brother, whether born of the same two parents, having the same national ancestor, any fellow man. And of course, then we have fellow believer. So I believe Jesus here is saying, how you treat my natural DNA brothers is going to have everything to do with how I deal with your nation. So how are the nations dealing with Israel? So on November 29, 2012, which incidentally is the anniversary of that November 29, 1947 vote. What just baffled my mind is that the Palestinians scheduled the vote on the day they think they were taken advantage of when they're the ones who rejected that partition plan in 1947. And yet they say, no, let's do this again. November 29, 2012. And how did the vote go? Ooh, the color's off a little bit. So, they were voting to get recognized as a non-member observer state. They are now on par with the Vatican because of this vote. The Vatican is a non-member state, observer state. And so this is what the map looks like. The yellow, brighter yellow, are the abstentions. The other, it's supposed to be green, the color's off, is all the people who voted in favor of this resolution, and then the darker colors are the ones who voted against it. So who voted what? So the tally, by the way, was 138-9, and 41 nations did not vote. Great Britain is one of the nations that did not vote. I thought that very interesting. Germany didn't vote either. France and Spain voted for. It doesn't look good. I think it's interesting that Britain and Germany didn't vote because they are allies of Israel and they didn't want to step into this one. But they're going to have to make a decision at some point. As you see, the U.S. and Canada voted against. Who else voted against? Canada, the Czech Republic, Israel, of course, the Marshall Islands, Micronesia, Nauru, Palau, Panama, and the U.S. Abstentions, Germany, Netherlands, the U.K., lots of other countries. Who voted for? France, Russia, Nigeria, South Africa, Spain. If you want me to look up a country, I can. I've got the list here. So right now, this is the tally. And right now, we have to pray that the nation you're concerned for changes its side. Because I really think this is a rough draft of the sheep goat nations. They're on record. This is on record. Let me read you a little bit of the resolution, because this is where it comes home for me. I love this. Recalling the resolution on November 29, 1947, the one they rejected. I don't have my highlighted version with me. Basically, it says, with Jerusalem as a capital, including East Jerusalem, that remains under military occupation. For those of you who have been in Israel, did East Jerusalem look like it was under military occupation to you? So this is basically, to me, is that they voted give Jerusalem back. I'm not finding the exact text. If you want to read it, I have it here. All relevant resolutions regarding the status of Jerusalem, bearing in mind that the annexation of East Jerusalem is not recognized by the international community, and emphasizing the need for a way to be found through negotiations to resolve the status of Jerusalem as the capital of two states. And there's others, more stronger language here. So I felt like this is the nations voting on, do we divide Jerusalem? Yeah, let's do it. Let's do it. There's an intercessor. His name is Thomas Sandel, and he's the head of the European Coalition for Israel, and he comes into Shkat Hillel a lot. I've seen him around. I haven't talked to him, although he's my Facebook friend. Social media is great. But, you know, he put it really well. He said, was this the final decision that sets Joel 3 and Matthew 25 into action? Of course not. But does this vote matter? Yes. And what he pointed out is that there's been several valleys of decision here. So in the 1920s, we get the League of Nations, which is the first time, he pointed out, this is the first time that there's an international organization that is representative of all the nations in 1920s, the League of Nations. And so what do? They create the British Mandate for Palestine. And then it's the organization that took over after World War II is the United Nations recreated. So in 1947, they vote 33-13 to create both Jewish and Arab states. And that's the vote that was rejected by the Arabs. And then we have another one, 1949. Israel's UN membership is approved, 37-12. So there we have the nations supporting Israel. And there's so many votes between there and now. The nations just start to keep going down this way. And there's a lot of political reasons why we won't get into. But and then we have here in 2012 that Palestine was recognized as a non-member observer state, 138-9, with East Jerusalem as the capital. So we have these foreshadowings, these little valleys of decisions, and this was the latest one. I think another one is coming, if not this year, next year. Last year, in June, John Kerry, I don't understand John Kerry's, John Kerry is the Secretary of State for the U.S. I don't understand his urgency, but suddenly, last June, he said, we're going to do something in 9 months. And everybody in the intercessor community first jumped. It's like, oh, 9 months, a gestation, a birth. This is interesting. And I decided to count. It's like, when's 9 months from now? It's the end of April. What happens in April? Passover. April, or Nisan, and this year they're lined up. Nisan 1 is April 1 on the Jewish calendar. Nisan is God's new year. He says in Exodus 12 that the year will start in the spring. So I think something is coming. And that's why I had an urgency to be back, and the Lord has been faithful. I'm going to get in 3 days before Nisan 1. So there is still time to intercede for each nation to repent on dividing the land. And that's our job, to stand in the gap for our nations. So we have the U.S. president endorsing the division of Jerusalem. The U.K. hasn't said its part officially on it. I saw that David Cameron was just over there last week. I thought that was interesting. I haven't been right on the news, so I didn't know exactly what transpired, except that he got to see the heckling that happens. I thought that was hilarious. They were playing that on the news here. They're like, oh, it makes us look good. Our parliament looks like it gets along. We have 138 nations on record ready to divide Jerusalem, and 41 who haven't been willing to be on the record either way. And we have Abraham, the great intercessor. You know, Sodom, we remember, was doomed because of their sin, and yet Abraham cried out on their behalf. And God was willing to spare the city if he found so many righteous men. And we see Abraham negotiating with God, the chutzpah to negotiate with God, but he did. He did. And so in the end, Lot gets saved. But I think it's a great example that Abraham, even though I'm sure he was fully aware of what was happening in Sodom and Gomorrah, he cried out in mercy for them. And that's our job. That's our job, is to cry out in mercy for our nations. And so we have that authority as sons of Abraham, as iterated in Romans 4 and Galatians 3, to negotiate with God for our nations. So here are a few verses to pray into. Psalm 2, a lovely passage that we want to see come. But it's perfect. Kings, be wise. Be warned, you judges of the earth. Serve Adonai with fear. Rejoice, but with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry, and you perish along the way. When suddenly his anger blazes, how blessed are all who take refuge in him. So pray this over your nation. Zechariah 9. This is interesting. Gaza will lose her king, and Ashkelon, if you remember, is one of the Philistine cities, will be deserted. A mongrel people will occupy Ashdod. And I will put an end to the pride of the Philistines. I will take the blood from their mouths, the forbidden food from between their teeth. Those who are left will belong to our God and become a clan in Judah, and Ekron will be like the Jebusites. What an amazing promise to the Palestinian people. He says, I will take the blood from your mouths. He's going to purify them, in other words. Take the forbidden food from between their teeth, and those who are left will belong to God, and they will become a clan in Judah. Not just a tribe, a clan of Judah, which is the tribe. It's the ruling tribe. So this is something at Sukkot Hallel that we pray into for the Palestinian people. I may have told you this before, but for those of you who haven't heard it, if you don't know, why do we call it Palestine today? That goes all the way back to the Romans. So the Romans, remember in Jesus' time, we have the Zealots, and they're looking for Messiah, and Jesus didn't look like him, so they're still looking for him, and they're fighting the Romans. And then in the 130, roughly, this guy comes up, Simon, that gets called Bar Kokhba, which means son of the star, as in the star of Numbers, the prophecy at the end of Numbers. And so the Romans finally come in, and this is 60 years after the temple's been destroyed, but they come in and they crush the rebellion once and for all, and they raise Jerusalem, they bulldoze it over. If they had bulldozers, they had people doing it, I'm sure. And they put a pagan temple on top of the Temple Mount, and they kick out all the Jews. And just to add insult to injury, they renamed the province. Up to this point, the province has been named what? Judea. And Hadrian, the emperor at the time, says, no, we shall call it Syria-Palestina. Palestina is the Latinized form of the Philistine. So it was very on purpose renamed for Israel's enemies. And the name persisted through the Palestinian mandate and then was claimed by the Arabs living there. And so they are claiming to be the Philistines. They are not. They're Arabs. The Philistines no longer exist. But we will pray this promise for Gaza on them. Okay. Jeremiah 12. So again, another promise. For the evil neighbors who encroach on my heritage, I gave to my people Israel as their possession. I will uproot them from their own land, and I will uproot Judah from among them. Then after I have uprooted them, I will take pity on them again, bring them back, each one to his inheritance, each one to his own land. Then if they will carefully learn my people's ways, swearing by my name, as Adonai lives, just as they taught my people to swear by Baal, they will be built up among my people. But if they refuse to listen, then I will uproot that nation, uproot and destroy it, says Adonai. So again, another hope for Israel's neighbors. And this is why we need to evangelize the Arabs, because Jesus is their hope here. And they will be grafted into Israel and be part of the land then. That's how they get the land. And then the last one here, Psalm 33. Adonai brings to nothing the plans of the nations. He foils the plans of the peoples. But the counsel of Adonai stands forever. His heart's plans are for all generations. How blessed is the nation whose God is Adonai, the people he chose as his heritage. So I hope that encourages you or gives you some more ammunition to pray for the nation. Because there's been a lot of different things that have happened. Like the one that jumped out at me from last year is the Church of Scotland put out a paper saying that there was no biblical basis for Israel being in the land. I couldn't believe it. And they ended up changing some wording because the Jewish groups in Scotland and then Israel itself complained, but they really didn't change the bulk of the paper. Those are dangerous things to be doing. And that's what we need to be standing in the gap for people who don't understand or they think they do and they don't. I want to point you to one more thing, and then I'm going to wrap up. And it's more to just say, here it is, research it for yourself. So in Joel 3 and Acts 2, this is another thing that has been driving me for about a year to get back into the land by next month. Adonai says, in the last days, I will pour out my spirit upon everyone. Your sons and daughters will prophesy. Your young men will see vision. Your old men will dream dreams. Even on my slaves, both men and women, I will pour out from my spirit in those days, and they will prophesy. And we know that. We know that from Pentecost. And we cling to it. And what follows? I will perform miracles in the sky above and signs on the earth below, blood, fire, and thick smoke. The sun will become dark, the moon blood before the great and fearful day of Adonai comes. And then whoever calls on the name of Adonai will be saved. So I remember reading these as a kid, and I'd be like, what does this mean? Well, it's actually very simple. It's very fancy language for lunar and solar eclipses. That's all it is. It's poetic language. And so we have this in Joel 3, and it's reiterated by Peter in Acts 2. And we have a couple of celestial events happening. A couple, actually, we have, what is this? Six celestial events, at least. I think there's some more. And it's just something to be aware about. I'm not going to say that it means anything. What I really think it means is pay attention. I was listening to a pastor, a messianic pastor. His name is Mark Biltz. And he pointed something really interesting out. Genesis 1:14, the creation of the lights in the sky. And it says, and they will be for a sign. That is their first purpose. A sign and for the seasons and then for the days and for the years. And so if you look up those words, signs, it means like a banner or flashing light, a signal. It's a signal. And then the seasons, if you look up that word, it's the same word that is used for appointments or for the feasts, the appointed times of the Lord. It also, by the way, is the same word for congregation. I thought that was very interesting. It's basically God's appointments for us to get together. And so, the color's off. So, what do we have? April 15th, we're going to have a full lunar eclipse. And that means the moon will turn red. What, of course, just to explain simple science, is you have the moon here, you have the earth here, and you have the sun. And when the earth gets in the way of the sun, the light is refracting around, and it bounces off red off of the moon. Otherwise, it's getting full sun and it looks white to us. So, and what's interesting is the reason it's a full, you got to remember that at the feast days, it's always on a full moon, the main feast days. So those are all full moons, and they're going to be full lunar eclipses. So there's going to be one at Passover. There's going to be one at the Feast of Tabernacles. And then, I didn't know this till recently, because I had just been looking at the moons for the last year. March 20th of next year, which is on God's New Year, Nisan 1, there's going to be a full solar eclipse. And that's the sun turning dark. Full solar eclipse. And then we're going to have again Passover, a partial eclipse on the first day of the Hebrew calendar, Feast of Trumpets, which is the anniversary of creation in Jewish tradition. And then we have a lunar eclipse on Sukkot of 2015. I have verified these for myself, by the way, just so you know. I went to the NASA website. They've got beautiful charts there. You can look up all the dates. And then I ran them through a Hebrew calendar just to do it for myself. So what is interesting is we have what they call these tetrads, these four lunar eclipses. They happen all the time. But only seven other times have they fallen right on the Jewish holidays. Seven other times in 2,000 years. And so here we have number eight happening. It's not going to happen again this century. I verified that myself as well. I went through all the charts one night and ran every date through a Hebrew converter just to prove it to myself. So this is the Lord flashing his lights at us. I really think that's what it is. And then it ties in with this deadline that John Kerry has put. So it'd be interesting if we get some sort of peace compromise next month. I actually think something's going to happen next year. But that's my personal thing. I'm still studying that out. I'm eager to get back in the land and feel the atmosphere there. So keep an eye out for this. Basically, like I said, I think the Lord is just saying, pay attention. Hey, I wasn't through. And being sober and vigilant, I want to recommend this book to you. I debated on whether to talk about this, but Mr. Bonhoeffer, or talk about this, and I decided on this. But this book ministered to me. It's been chasing me since 2010, is when I first heard about it. Somebody was reading it during the internship. And then somebody asked me last year, have you read it? No, it's on my list. I haven't read. And then I ran into another friend at the beginning of the year. And she said, oh, I read it. Have you read it? I said, no, I haven't gotten to it. And she went to her bedroom and got me a copy and said, here, read it. And so I did. If you don't know, Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a German pastor during World War II. He was extraordinary because he decided somewhere along the line that he was going to be part of the plot to assassinate Hitler. And a lot has been said about his decision to do this, whether it was a Christian thing to do. I think you have to make your own decision. Read the book. But what really struck me about this man, well, a lot of things. It's just, he's extraordinary. I felt like I was meeting my brother, and I missed him when I finished reading the book. I cried at the end because, if you don't know, he dies. He is executed for treason. And the author says this, but I came to a conclusion before I got to that point. He was a Jeremiah for Germany. He saw what was coming before most people did. He was preaching about it, and he was fighting it. And the reason I think it's important for several reasons. One, I think too many times, at least from my education, we have this idea that Germany just rolled over and died and succumbed to the demonic force that was Hitler. And it's not true. There were a lot of people fighting, a lot, and he's one of them. One of the first signs was the Nazis taking over the church. And one of the first things they did is they kicked out the Jews out of the church. Anyone with Jewish blood could not be part of the German church. And this just annoyed him. He spoke out, and he made people speak out about it. And so that's important. And the other reason is because I think we're going to come into very dark times eventually. And he is an example of how to deal with it. One thing I liked about him is he didn't want anybody to follow his example, so I'm not telling you to follow his example. He wanted people to sort it out between themselves and God, because he knew that everybody's called to something different. He knew that his draft number was about to come up, and he didn't know how to deal with it. He didn't want to be a conscientious objector, because then he felt like all the other pastors were going to follow his lead, and that's not what he felt everybody should do. He didn't want to join the army because, he just didn't want to be an example. Everybody has to make their decision for themselves, has to figure out where God wants them during the war for themselves. But it's just really cool to see his progression, his spiritual progression. He's very intellectual. And then all of a sudden, at 24 or 25, he realizes he's never really prayed before. He's got a doctorate in divinity, and he's about to be ordained, but he's never really prayed before. And he learns to pray at a black church in New York City. He learns to worship with this black church in New York City. and brings that back, and brings back meditation, things that were too Catholic for these Germans. Anyway, I encourage you, read it. It is an easy read. It's very readable. It reads like a novel, but the history is sound, and I think it will encourage you and inspire you for whatever challenges the Lord has for you. Let me close in prayer. Lord, I just thank you so much that you meet us here. I thank you. I thank you for your prophetic word, Lord. You laid out everything in advance and you've given it to us. So give us the discernment, give us the understanding to rightly divide your word of truth, Lord, and to rightly discern the signs and to speak out in boldness and to stand in the gap for our nations and our cities and our neighborhoods. Lord, put us all where you want us. Let us know exactly what our assignments are, Lord, and help us to know in all confidence that we are where you want us to be, and to then serve you faithfully there. I just thank you for the examples you've set for us, the heroes of faith from the Bible, from Hebrews 11, on through all the martyrs up to now, Lord. Help us to learn from their example and to press forward as we look forward to your coming. The Spirit and the Bride say come. Amen.